Lecture 2, Adam Smith and the Birth of Economics.
Adam Smith was a very well-read man. He'd read many, many of the mercantilist thinkers. He was good friends with David Hume. They were together at the same university. He visited the physiocrats in Paris. He was certainly aware of Bernard de Mandeville's work. And so the thing about Smith, which is really interesting from an economics point of view, is not so much his raw originality, but the fact that he took information and thoughts and insights that were partially developed in all of these sources and blended them together into a system. And that's why we sort of give him credit as being the parent of economics as a discipline. Let me begin by giving you a little bit of biographical information about Smith, but the honest truth is, he's not a man where the biographical details are thick on the ground. He's a man of the 18th century, born 1723, dies in 1790, born in Scotland. His father died before he was born, and he lived with his mother much of his life. She lived until the age of 90 and didn't die until 6 years before he did. So he was a real mother's boy. He never married. He went to the University of Glasgow at age 14, which was the normal age at the time, and then on to Oxford, Balliol College. He was scathing about his time at Oxford, where he just hated it and thought that no one bothered to have anything to do with education. In The Wealth of Nations, in a chapter on education, he wrote, "In the University of Oxford, the greater part of the public professors have these many years given up even the pretense of teaching. They are likely to make a common cause, to be all very indulgent to one another, and every man to consent his neighbor may neglect his duty, provided he himself is allowed to neglect his own. The discipline of colleges and universities is in general contrived not for the benefit of the students, but for the interest, or more properly speaking, for the ease of the masters. Its object is, in all cases, to maintain the authority of the master, and whether he neglects or performs his duty, to oblige the students in all cases to behave toward him as if he performed it with the greatest diligence and ability." Just so you know, complaints about teaching have been the same for several centuries now. After leaving Oxford, he went back to become a professor at the University of Glasgow. We're up to about the 1750s now, where he was a colleague of David Hume's, and they used to sit around in the evening discussing economics and other issues. He wrote his first book in the 1750s called The Moral Sentiments. It was a smash hit. Made him a popular figure. People used to stop him on the street and ask him his opinions as a best-selling author of his time. At about this time, a devotee of his, named Charles Townsend, married a countess, and he offered Smith a lifetime salary of £500 a year if Smith would give up his position at Glasgow and tutor Townsend's son. This was roughly double Smith's annual salary at Glasgow, and so he decided to quit being a professor and tutor the young Mr. Townsend. At the time, when you were a college professor, your students paid you fees directly. It paid directly to the teacher. And so since he was leaving halfway through the school term, he offered to refund all the money to his students. And his students, the story goes, said they had already learned more than enough to compensate them for the fees they had paid, and they refused to take any of the money back. As a tutor, he was able to travel to France, where he met François Quesnay and the physiocrats. In fact, he was so impressed by the physiocrats that he was originally planning to dedicate his great economics work, The Wealth of Nations, to Quesnay. But Quesnay died before the book was actually published. He eventually returned to London, where he lived with some years. He was good friends with people like Edmund Burke and Samuel Johnson, and published The Wealth of Nations in 1776. He'd been working on it for years and years. It, again, was a huge and immediate success. Scotland eventually decided they wanted this native son to come back to Scotland, so they offered him the position of Commissioner of Customs, which, if you think about this great advocate of free trade, it's a little odd that he was Commissioner of Customs. But it was a job that they could give him, and he didn't have to do anything, and he would move back to Scotland and live there. So he moved back to Scotland, back to Glasgow, back to the university, basically lived with his mother, and after her death, lived with a cousin. At his death, he called up his friends and had them burn, apparently, 16 volumes of his collected writings, which were his next book, which was to be on jurisprudence. Social scientists ever since have wondered what was in those books and in those 16 volumes. We'll never know. What was the view of economics at the time that Smith is thinking about the subject? Well, remember, economics is not a very well-defined field. In fact, the whole idea of economics is somehow not really even a title you would put on people. The physiocrats aren't even being called les économistes yet. Smith was officially a professor of logic, and he held the chair of moral philosophy in the logic department. In his view, moral philosophy was divided into four branches: natural theology, ethics, jurisprudence, and political economy. And his notion was that he would first do a book on ethics, then one on political economy, then one on jurisprudence, and I think perhaps eventually one on religion. So that was the path that he set out for in his academic career. His first book, his book on ethics, was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Now, I'm going to give you the opening passage from the book, but before I do that, just remember for a moment the popular image of Adam Smith. You know, this is the guy who's the cutthroat capitalist, believes people are selfish, believes the market should be allowed to work. All those sorts of stereotypes people carry around in their mind about Smith. This is the opening passage of his book on the moral sentiments. How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others, and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. His problem in the book Moral Sentiments was to explain, why do people have moral sentiments? Why do people care about others? And the answer he gives, which is not a wholly satisfactory one, but an interesting one, is that people develop a sympathetic understanding with others. They put people in other people's shoes, and their self in other people's shoes, and they care about what other people think about them. And because of all those things, you develop a kind of a sympathetic understanding of what other people are going through. And that's why you have moral sentiments. Moral sentiments come from this sympathy that's built up with other folks. Now, there's a long philosophical tradition since then coming down about, you know, that argument, whether it makes sense, the extent to which it makes sense. I don't want to claim Smith was the world's best ethical philosopher. But this book, and what was called even in Germany, Das Adam Smith Problem, was a problem that perplexed philosophers of the time. And Smith was certainly thought of as one of the leading writers in trying to address it. The Moral Sentiments is a really interesting book, and I think it's deeply underappreciated. Economists don't read it, of course, because it's not about economics, and so why would we care? And I think many philosophers are put off by it because they're put off by the fact that Adam Smith wrote it. And in our modern view, you just don't see economists writing ethical philosophy. In that time, of course, the two things went together just fine. When you think about Adam Smith, it's important to remember that his notion of markets and the good life and how people ought to live was really set in this broad humanitarian context of thinking about moral sentiments and ethics, because he didn't see any big contradiction between his ethics and his economics. Well, 1776, Smith's Economics, The Wealth of Nations, the founding of the discipline of economics. What can I tell you about The Wealth of Nations? It's a sweeping book, a grandiose book, an unbelievably textured and detailed book. It's beautifully written. It's written with a deep concern and interest in human nature. It rewards reading even today. However, I don't recommend you try and read all of it. It's well over 1,000 pages. And he has a tendency, as authors did in that time, to sort of go off on some digression for 20 or 30 pages before he comes back to the main point. And you can be reading along just thinking, I just don't know where this is going. My favorite digression is there's one called A Digression Concerning the Variations in the Value of Silver During the Course of the Last 4 Centuries. It goes on for about 90 pages, and then he sort of comes back to his main argument later on. So if you pick up The Wealth, just remember that it kind of rambles in places. The full title of the book is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. So, what are the nature and causes of the wealth of nations? What are the building blocks of Adam Smith? I'm going to try and describe to you a little bit by quoting pieces from The Wealth of Nations, because I think it's important that you have a sense of Smith somewhat in his own words, and because he is a lovely writer in so many ways. His building block, the starting point of The Wealth of Nations, is the idea of the division of labor. And by division of labor, he means just that instead of each of us providing everything for ourselves, all our food, shelter, clothing, we specialize in particular areas. And as we specialize in those particular areas, we can be more productive as a result. His classic example that starts The Wealth of Nations is the example of a pin factory. He says, take an example, this is quoting from The Wealth of Nations, take an example, the trade of the pin maker. A worker not educated to this business, nor acquainted with the use of the machinery employed in it, could scarce, perhaps with his utmost industry, make one pin in a day, and certainly could not make 20. But in the way in which this business is now carried on, not only the whole work is a peculiar trade, but it is divided into a number of branches, of which the greater part are likewise peculiar trades. One man draws out the wire, another straights it, a third cuts it, a fourth points it, a fifth grinds it at the top for receiving the head. To make the head requires two or three distinct operations. To put it on is a peculiar business. To whiten the pins is another. It is even a trade by itself to put them into the paper. And the important business of making a pin is, in this manner, divided into about 18 distinct operations, which in some manufactories are all performed by distinct hands, although in others the same man will sometimes perform two or three of them. I have seen a small manufactory of this kind where only 10 men were employed. But although they were very poor, and therefore but indifferently accommodated with the necessary machinery, they could, when they exerted themselves, make among them about 12 pounds of pins in a day. There are in a pound upwards of 4,000 pins of middling size. Those 10 persons, therefore, could make among them upwards of 48,000 pins in a day. Each person, therefore, making a tenth part of 48,000 pins might be considered as making 4,800 pins in a day. So, lesson. One person making pins maybe can make 10 pins in a day, 20. 10 people working together, dividing the labor into different jobs, can multiply that enormously. And Smith saw the entire economy as a process of people specializing in particular jobs and becoming enormously more productive as a result. Why is it that the division of labor makes people more productive? Remember, we're not just talking anecdotes now in the sense of the mercantilist writers. Smith felt there was something to give actual reasons and examples behind his reasons. So, why is the division of labor makes you more productive? Well, he offers three reasons. The first one is that just as you do something repeatedly, you get better at it. He writes later on, a common smith who, though accustomed to handle the hammer, has never been used to make nails, if upon some occasion he is obliged to attempt it, will scarce, I am assured, be able to make above 200 or 300 nails in a day, and those very bad ones. But a smith who has been accustomed to make nails, and whose sole or principal business has been that of a nailer, he goes on and says someone who's of medium experience can only make 800 or 1,000 nails a day. But then he says, I've seen several boys under 20 years of age who have never exercised any other trade but that of making nails, and who, when they exerted themselves, could make each of them upwards of 2,300 nails in a day. And so, just getting more practice helps you in terms of division of labor to become more productive. A second reason is that if you're doing all the different tasks, you have to move from one job to another. And Smith argued that as you move from one job or another, you tend to waste time. You tend to saunter, as he puts it. So, as he writes, a man commonly saunters a little in turning his hand from one sort of employment to another. When he first begins the new work, he's seldom very keen and hearty. His mind, as they say, does not go to it. And for some time, he rather trifles than applies to good purpose. The habit of sauntering and of indolent, careless application, which is naturally acquired by every country workman who's obliged to change his work and his tools every half hour and to apply his hand in 20 different ways almost every day of his life, renders him almost always slothful and lazy and incapable of any vigorous application, even on the most pressing occasions. So a second reason the division of labor helps productivity is you're not jumping back and forth between things and taking little breaks all the time. Third reason it makes a difference. It helps the invention of machinery. When you focus on one particular task, you think about how it's done in a way that encourages the invention of new machinery. And Smith tells a story later on in The Wealth about the steam engine. He says, in the first fire engine, by which he means a steam engine, a boy was constantly employed to open and shut alternately the communication between the boiler and the cylinder, according as the piston ascended or descended. One of those boys who loved to play with his companions observed that by tying a string from the handle on the valve which opened this communication to another part of the machine, the valve would open and shut without his assistance and leave him at liberty to divert himself with his playfellows. One of the greatest improvements that has been made upon this machine since it was first invented was in this manner the discovery of a boy who wanted to save his own labor. Now, this story is probably not true. But the point about Smith is he's trying to come up with examples of how things work and draw on different industries and different observation and different background. And that makes him different as a systematic thinker than those who went before. When we get all this division of labor, what happens as a result? What happens as a result is that we're all interrelated to each other in a lot of ways which are very difficult to describe. Smith gives one particular example of the woolen coat of a worker and all the effort and connection that goes into that coat. The woolen coat, for example, which covers the day laborer, as coarse and rough as it may appear, is the produce of the joint labor of a great multitude of workmen. The shepherd, the sorter of wool, the wool comber, a carter, the dyer, the scribbler, the spinner, the weaver, the fuller, the dresser, with many others, all must join their different arts in order to complete even this homely production. How many merchants and carriers besides must have been employed in transporting the materials from some of these workmen to others, who often live in a very distant part of the country? How much commerce and navigation, in particular, how many shipbuilders, sailors, sailmakers, rope makers must have been employed in order to bring together the different drugs made use of by the dyer, which also come from the remotest corners of the world? What a variety of labor is necessary in order to produce the tools of the meanest of these workmen? To say nothing of the complicated machines as the ship of the sailor, the mill of the fuller, the loom of the weaver. And he goes on and on saying, even when you think about something like a simple coat that somebody wears, by the time you go back through the division of labor and you think of all the different ways that that's happened, you have just an enormous number of interconnections in the economy. And that thinking about the economy as this web of interconnections is something which is not wholly original to Smith, but he really put in a way that no one else really had before. So, we have this interconnected market, all these people making things, trading things back and forth. What's the second building block after the division of labor? I would say the second building block for Smith is what he refers to as the propensity to truck and barter, the propensity to trade. And so he writes, for example, the division of labor is the necessary, though a very slow and gradual consequence, of a propensity in human nature, the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing or another. Nobody ever saw a dog make a fair and deliberate exchange of one bone for another with another dog. Nobody ever saw one animal by its gestures and natural cries signify to another, this is mine, that yours, I am willing to give this for that. So we felt there was some sort of natural tendency in people that we like to trade stuff back and forth with each other. Now, as we trade things back and forth, of course, we're trying to act in our own self-interest. And as Mandeville pointed out, when we act in our own self-interest, that provides motivation for other people to engage in these trades back and forth. So Smith emphasizes this role of self-interest and how it motivates people. He writes, "Man has almost constant occasion for the help of his brethren, and it is in vain for him to expect it from their benevolence only. He will be more likely to prevail if he can interest their self-love in his favor and show them that it is for their own advantage to do for him what he requires of them. Whoever offers a bargain of any kind proposes this, give me that what I want, and you shall have this which you want. That's the meaning of every offer. And it is in this manner we obtain from one another the far greater part of those good offices which we stand in need of." This is a famous line. "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from regard to their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages. Nobody but a beggar chooses to depend chiefly on the benevolence of his fellow citizens." So this notion that benevolence is a good thing. Remember the moral sentiments. People do have an interest in others. But in our day-to-day lives, we go to people and we say, we'll pay you for that. We're going to appeal to your self-interest. We're not going to appeal to, please give me this because I'm a nice person. So the notion that the world works on self-interest and that that's a central part of the mechanism is something that comes out of Smith in a strong way. A fourth building block, then, of the wealth of nations is that when we have all these people acting in their own self-interest, the whole system will fit together some well, as if guided, in Smith's famous phrase, by an invisible hand. Let me quote you the passage where that term comes from. He's talking about individuals trying to benefit themselves, and he says, "An individual generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. By directing industry in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value, he intends only his own gain. But he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention." Nor is it always the worse for the society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interest, the individual frequently promotes the interest of society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. I have never known much good done by those who affected to trade for the public good. It is an affectation, indeed, not very common among merchants, and very few words need be employed in dissuading them from it. That last part is beautiful, cynical Smith. You know, people who say, oh, it's all in the public interest, those mercantilist writers, don't trust them. Let's talk about self-interest. Let's keep straight on what we're talking about here. Actually, one interesting side note is that mention of the invisible hand I read to you is the only place the invisible hand is mentioned in The Wealth of Nations in this 1,000-page book. It's not an image that comes up over and over again, but it's clearly one which is echoed down to us as being of strong importance. Other parts of the book offer a strong attack on the mercantilists, a discussion of the physiocrats, discussions of history, and all kinds of things. In his attack on mercantilism, for example, he emphasizes that, you know, bullion is not the same as wealth, the point that David Hume made earlier on. He also emphasizes that the virtues of free trade are virtues where you can trade back and forth between countries, and that'll be a situation where everyone can end up better off as a result. In thinking about bullion and thinking about free trade, he discusses the example of Genghis Khan. And he says, a rich country, in the same manner as a rich man, is supposed to be a country abounding in money. And to heap up gold and silver in any country is supposed to be the way to enrich it. Clearly, attack on the mercantilists here. He says, for some time after the discovery of America, the first inquiry of the Spaniards when they arrived on any coast used to be, is there any gold or silver to be found in the neighborhood? By the information they received, they judged whether it was worthwhile to make a settlement there, or if the country was worth the conquering. Plano Carpino, a monk, sent ambassador from the king of France to one of the sons of the famous Genghis Khan, said the Tartars used to ask him if there were plenty of sheep and oxen in the kingdom of France. Their inquiry had the same object with the Spaniards. They wanted to know if the country was rich enough to be worth conquering. Among the Tartars, who are generally ignorant of the use of money, cattle are the instruments of commerce and the measure of wealth. Wealth, according to them, consisted in cattle. As according to the Spaniards, it consisted in gold and silver. Of the two notions, the Tartar notion was probably nearer to the truth. An argument that money isn't what's important. What's important is things like cattle that you can actually live and eat and deal with. More and more, he began to focus on this notion of individuals seeking out their own benefit and building on the notion that when you trade, that benefits individuals, and that individuals are the outcome, the natural outcome, of what we should be aiming for when we think about economic behavior. Now, what are the shortcomings of Adam Smith? I confess that as an economist, when I hear shortcomings of Adam Smith, my little heart just goes pit-a-pat, because you have such loyalty to the man if you're an economist, it's hard to think that he ever had any shortcomings. But when I say shortcomings of Adam Smith, I don't usually mean things that he was flatly wrong about. It's very hard to find things like that. There are few, but there aren't many. What I really mean is problems that he addressed with concepts and terms and ideas that from our modern point of view just don't seem to work very well. That he somehow didn't come up with a language which helps him to tackle these problems sensibly. One difficulty like this is what we call today the dispute over value. Where does value come from? How is the price of something determined? Those were questions economists set out to answer. Now, Smith gave us one very useful distinction here. He said that value was going to be different than price a lot of the time. And his classic example here is an example of diamonds and water. He wrote in The Wealth of Nations, the word value, it is to be observed, has two different meanings, and sometimes expresses the utility of some particular object, and sometimes the power of purchasing other goods, which the possession of that object conveys. One meaning might be called value in use, the other, value in exchange. The things which have the greatest value in use have frequently little or no value in exchange. And on the contrary, those which have the greatest value in exchange have frequently little or no value in use. Nothing is more useful than water, but it will purchase scarce anything. Scarce anything can be had in exchange for it. A diamond, on the other hand, has scarce any value in use, but a great quantity of other goods may frequently be had in exchange for it. So he began to separate out usefulness of something is not the same as the price of it. Well, if usefulness and price or value in exchange are not the same thing, what is the source? He proposed at one point that labor would be the source of value. He wrote, "Labor alone, never varying in its own value, is alone the ultimate and real standard by which the value of all commodities can at all times be estimated and compared. It is their real price." So there's a labor theory of value. The value of things comes from labor, and that somehow determines their price. Now, this theory is going to be very popular. We're going to come back to it over and over again, a labor theory of value. But it's worth saying just at the start, it's not obviously right. I mean, he says labor being always the same. What does that mean? There are a variety of different kinds of labor. People are trained in many different ways. If you put labor into something that nobody wants to buy, does that have value? I mean, how can it have value if nobody wants to buy it? This link between labor and value is clearly somewhat there, but, you know, it's not as firm as one might think. And Smith then also talks about the value in material goods, like the early example of cattle that the Tartars and Genghis Khan were looking to. A second dispute that he struggles with is a struggle where he's searching for what he calls the natural price of things. And the natural price is again something where you think, well, if labor gives you the value, then certainly that should be related to the natural price of items. But, he writes in The Wealth of Nations, when the price of any commodity is neither more nor less than what is sufficient to pay the rent of the land, the wages of labor, and the profits of stock employed in raising, preparing, and bringing it to market according to their natural rates, the commodity is then sold for what might be called its natural price. So here he's bringing in not just labor, but the cost of transportation and shipping and capital and all these other things. And somehow that's what value is, or that's what the natural price is. My point here is just to say that on value and price, Smith is a person of his time struggling for an answer. Partly he talks about labor, partly he talks about cost of production. He doesn't give what I think we would call a satisfactory answer. Smith also talks some about how an economy develops and evolves. And he begins, of course, with the physiocrat's framework of landlords, workers, and manufacturers, or what we would now call capitalists. He takes these three great groups from the physiocrat analysis and talks about what will happen to society as these groups interact. And although he's not real clear on this, it's not easy to give you a quotation that sums it up, he sort of sees the world as a race on the one hand between manufacturers building up and accumulating more capital, which will raise everybody's standard of living, and people being born. And as more and more people are born, that will depress the average standard of living. So he sees these two forces in conflict against each other. So the capitalists are out there in their own self-interest trying to invest, trying to earn more profits. And as they do that, they pay higher and higher wages. But as wages go up, people have more and more kids. The birth rate goes up, the number of workers go up, and that pulls the wage back down. So that process is going on back and forth over time. And although Smith is not very clear on the point, it seems that he believes that in the very long run, you'll end up in a situation where basically the workers are just being paid subsistence wages. Because after all, the birth rate will just keep going up and up and up. There'll be more and more and more workers. And it'll be harder and harder to find new investments which work well. So it'll be harder and harder to keep raising the level of productivity in that way. On the other hand, Smith doesn't seem very worried about this outcome. He seems to sort of say, well, you know, in the middle term, I think things can keep going up for a while. We can be better off over time. And the capitalist accumulation will lead to a somewhat higher standard of living. There'll be a lag time. There'll be a period of time that'll take a while before the birth rate and the population get so high that we are pushing everyone down to a subsistence level of living. Now, in a way, this is a little unsatisfactory. I mean, you sort of say, well, everything's fine now, and probably will be fine for a while, but in the long term, you should worry about it. In a way, though, I think that's a very human sort of response. In a way, it's kind of how I feel about the world. I think we're going to be fine the next 100, 200 years. After that, maybe everything will go to pieces. But I think that Smith's attitude here is, again, something where you can't really pull a fully consistent, easy view out of this. Except that he was fairly optimistic about gains in his own lifetime, at least. Why is it so rewarding to read Adam Smith? I think it's largely because Smith is willing to avoid formulas. He's willing to make disturbing, blunt statements. He's willing to avoid being doctrinaire. Smith is not an ideologue. Many of the people who quote Adam Smith are much more ideologically one track than Adam Smith ever was. To give you a couple examples of Smith's willingness to be appropriately cynical and appropriately thoughtful about everything. In later parts of The Wealth of Nations, he describes different roles for government. And he's clearly not a pure laissez-faire, physiocrat, let-it-all-go kind of person. Among this chapter, he talks about the government role in national defense, in law enforcement, in setting up copyrights and patents, in enforcing contracts, in regulating mortgages, in issuing control over paper money and the banking system. He proposes taxing alcohol to reduce the consumption of alcohol, because it's not good for people. He proposes limits on the rate of interest to make sure that people don't borrow money at a really high interest rate and be able to not pay it back. He talks about how it might be unrealistic to have free trade right away, and unrealistic to have trade all the time, that sometimes you're going to need to do some things for foreign policy reasons. He talks about public works projects like roads and canals. He talks about education and how it's important for the government to provide education for the future. And so in all those ways, if you think of Adam Smith as just someone who says, just let that market rip, you're wrong. I mean, that's not how Adam Smith saw the world. He was a practical guy, a Scottish philosopher, and he was clearly willing to see the world in much more nuanced kinds of ways than that. To give you a sense of the consistency of his skepticism, you know, he wasn't someone who sort of thought, as you sometimes caricature Smith, well, you know, just leave it to the business people. The business people are smart. That's not right. Smith was not willing to say to anyone, well, you know, we'll just leave it in their hands. He really took seriously this notion that self-interest was going to be greediness and you had to keep it under control. To give you an example of how skeptical he was, he has this beautiful notion of the division of labor and how that creates jobs for everyone. Well, a common complaint about the division of labor, of course, is it makes people stupid. I mean, think of this one guy who's doing nothing every day but cutting the pin, you know, over and over, 48,000 pins a day. And a modern objection to that is, this is an awful way to think about people working. You know, how can you advocate something like that? Well, Smith is not someone who would shy away from problems like that. He wrote in The Wealth of Nations, "The men whose whole life is spent in performing a few simple operations, of which the effects, too, are perhaps always the same or very nearly the same, has no occasion to exert his understanding or to exercise his invention in finding out expedients for removing difficulties. He naturally loses, therefore, the habit of such exertion and generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become. The torpor of his mind renders him not only incapable of relishing or bearing a part in any rational conversation, but of conceiving any generous, noble, or tender sentiment, and consequently of forming any judgment concerning many, even of the ordinary duties of private life. His dexterity at his own particular trade seems in this manner to be acquired at the expense of his intellectual, social, and martial virtues. But in every improved and civilized society, this is the state into which the laboring poor, that is, the great body of people, will necessarily fall unless government takes some pains to prevent it." And then he launches into his discussion of why we need to have public education, precisely in order to avoid that kind of a problem. Now, that may not be a fully satisfactory answer. My point is, Smith doesn't duck hard questions. He has his beautiful theory of the division of labor that he's basing everything on. And even so, he's willing to criticize it, say, look, this is a problem, it's a real problem, and here's the solution for it. And there's a certain honesty there that's downright refreshing. Let me give you a second example. He talks about landlords, you know, and how landlords will be collecting money from various folks. But, you know, he's deeply cynical about landlords. Nowadays, we say, well, what is the landlord doing? They're just sitting there collecting rent. Smith was every bit as cynical as you or I about this. He writes, "Landlords are the only one of the three orders," remember that's farmers, manufacturers, landlords, "whose revenue costs them neither labor nor care, but comes to them as it were of its own accord and independent of any plan or project of their own. That indolence, which is the natural effect of the ease and security of their situation, renders them too often not only ignorant, but incapable of that application of mind, which is necessary to foresee and understand the consequence of any public regulation." Man, don't listen to the landlords. They're dumb. I mean, they're doing nothing but collecting rent. And Smith, again, is deeply willing to look in a very human way at people and what their situations are providing. What about business people? Do we trust business people in order to do different things? Well, of course not. Smith writes, "People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices." And you get business people together, even if it's for a social occasion. What do? They start talking about how they can raise prices and make more money. Later on, Smith wrote, "The interest of dealers, however, in any particular branch of trade or manufactures is always in some respects different from and even opposite to the interest of the public. The proposal of any new law or regulation of commerce which comes from this order ought always to be listened to with great precaution and ought never to be adopted until after having been long and carefully examined, not only with the most scrupulous but with the most suspicious attention. It comes from an order of men whose interest is never exactly the same as the public and who have generally an interest to deceive and even to oppress the public." And when you talk about mercantilists proposing rules for how they should look after their own businesses, Smith is deeply concerned that those people are going to be getting together and taking advantage of their situation over and over. He was equally uncertain about the untrustworthiness of government. Yeah, sure, he's willing to say government has a role to do all these different things that I listed off before, but in a number of places he points out how government can be wasteful in doing these things, can miss the point, can do them in the wrong ways. Smith, in all of these areas, just has a very human view of people. I think that in our politicized times, everyone who is an economist, you tend to say to those people, well, you know, what side are you on? You know, you're a Republican economist or a Democrat economist? Do you believe in the free market or don't you believe in the free market? And one of the ways in which Adam Smith is, I think, a model for economists is that he doesn't categorize that way. Sure, he writes about the division of labor, about self-interest, about the invisible hand, and all the power of markets, and the power of material things and how they're produced. On the other hand, he's very willing to admit difficulties, problems, where the government might enter in. Adam Smith is bluntly, breathtakingly honest about things. It's unsettling to read Smith, because you keep thinking, well, here's a real problem, and I'll bet, you know, he's not going to face up to that. And, you know, 300 pages later, after going through numerous digressions, he'll say, yep, this is a real problem, and we need to think about how to deal with it, and here's my proposal. I think that's fascinating. I think it's an example that more of us could kind of follow. Moreover, I think that Smith's skepticism, properly applied, gives you an interesting view of how to think about government. Smith was not skeptical of government because he thought government was evil. He just applied to government the same ideas of self-interest that he applied to everybody else. When you look back at the mercantilists, you look back at Colbert, you look at Josiah Child, remember that in their view, the role of government was to help business. And so in Smith's view, what you got when you got government was monopoly. What you got when you got government was oppressing people in order to help big business. And so his very limited agenda for government was a very different agenda from the agenda of people like the mercantilists. He was talking about building roads and canals, not about giving subsidies to favored industries. So don't pigeonhole Smith. Smith is just too sophisticated for that. One economist said a few years ago that if you think Smith is wrong, you should probably go back and examine your own thinking, because the odds are he's right and you're wrong. He's too deep a guy to be easily trapped. So how do we think about Adam Smith as we leave him? Smith was known for his lectures. He was known for his absent-mindedness. He was your typical scholarly academic who tended to forget things all the time. And so he was apparently beloved by many people for his absent-mindedness as well as for his beautiful lectures. He used to walk the streets of Glasgow talking to himself. One person who wrote a letter at the time described the way he walked as vermicular, which means worm-like. And apparently he kind of wavered back and forth as he walked, bumping off walls. He was occasionally, when he was out walking, people would call and say there was a lunatic out and talking to himself who needed to be arrested and taken in. One story about Smith is that once when he was out walking with Charles Townsend, the guy who paid him the money to tutor his son, he was talking excitedly about the division of labor and not looking where he was going, and fell into a tanning pit, which is, you know, where hides and lime and things like that were all mixed together and had to be hauled out and taken home. Another story is that Smith went out for a swim one day, and on his way back from the beach, he took a wrong turn, and he walked 15 miles, thinking to himself about economics, until he showed up in a neighboring town, wearing his swim trunks and his bathroom garb on a Sunday morning as everyone was setting off for church and had to be rescued and taken back home again. One of the classic stories, which is taken from the diary of a woman at the time, she invited Smith over for tea. And she said, as he was going to breakfast and falling into discourse, Mr. Smith took a piece of bread and butter, which after he had rolled it round and round, he put into the teapot and poured the water on it. Sometime after, he poured it into a cup, and when he had tasted it, he said it was the worst tea he had ever met with. Another observer at the time saw Smith at a party and said, he was the most absent man in company I ever saw, moving his lips and talking to himself and smiling in the midst of large companies. If you asked him from his reverie and made him attend to the subject of conversation, he immediately began a harangue and never stopped till he told you all he knew about it, with the utmost philosophical ingenuity. So when you think of Smith, you have to sort of think of this man roaming around, saying these things, rambling from one place to another, but deeply beloved of his friends and students, deeply beloved of David Hume. All the contemporary accounts of him speak of a certain gentleness, a certain kindliness, a certain humanity. It's almost impossible to find a harsh word written about the man, which is quite an accomplishment to leave behind. In 1991, the Nobel laureate in economics was named Ronald Coase. And Coase, in his Nobel laureate address describing his own work, said, during the two centuries since the publication of The Wealth of Nations, the main activity of economists, seems to me, has been to fill the gaps in Adam Smith's system, to correct his errors, and to make his analysis vastly more exact. When you think about it, that's a remarkable thing, that someone could write a book in 1776 and that, as the 20th century draws to a close, what we would still be doing is sharpening their analysis, thinking about what's really meant by the invisible hand, thinking about intervention of the government, thinking about rules for free trade, thinking about how all those different things could fit together. This gentle, absent-minded professor laid out an intellectual agenda which has held up well for over two centuries. And moreover, he got a lot of it right the first time around, which is really an astounding intellectual accomplishment.